So this evening I'd like to start exploring the title of this retreat, which is Strengthening the Two Wings of Awakening, Wisdom and Compassion. And I'm curious, how many of you knew that that was the theme of this retreat? Oh, okay. Usually people have no idea. So just as well I'm talking about it then. So I chose this theme partly because in my own experience of having sat a lot of retreats in the so-called insight tradition, there often seems to be an artificial separation between the wisdom practices, the foundations of mindfulness, and what we might think of as the heart practices, the four Brahmavihara qualities that I mentioned briefly the other day of kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity. And these are four very beneficial states of heart and mind that we can cultivate directly through specific meditation practices. And we'll be starting some of those practices probably tomorrow, perhaps the day after. And even though these Brahmavihara qualities are so beneficial, not only in formal meditation practice, but also in daily life, in my own experience and meeting with a lot of students in different places around the world, most people's practice is much more heavily weighted towards the insight side and much less towards these Brahmavihara qualities. And yet the need for balance is woven throughout the Buddha's teachings. Some of you may know that the first discourse he gave after his awakening or enlightenment was framed in terms of what he called the middle way. The balance between extremes of any kind. And this need for balance came out of his own life experience. According to the legend, he lived the early part of his life as a prince. So he was able to indulge every kind of sense pleasure imaginable. But eventually, at the age of 27 or so, he got tired of all of that hedonism, and he started to wander in search of a meaningful life. And for a while, he went to the opposite extreme, moving away from that self-indulgence towards total austerity. He went and practiced with all of the foremost spiritual teachers of his day, and most of what they were offering were fairly hardcore ascetic practices. Things like sleeping on beds of nails, or not sleeping at all for days, taking vows to never lie down, and only eating extremely tiny amounts of food. And the Buddha-to-be was a very determined student, so he performed all of these practices very rigorously. In fact, so rigorously that he almost died. And he was actually at the point of death when he started to wonder if he'd perhaps got off track some way. So he changed his tactics. He started to eat enough to get his physical strength back. And he started to develop the jhana practices, states of deep absorption or meditation, samadhi, more fully. And it's said that not long after this change of course, he attained complete awakening, complete freedom of heart and mind, known as nibbana. And then after that awakening experience, the first discourse he gave was about this need to find the middle way, the balance point between self-indulgence on one hand and self-mortification on the other. Now I'm guessing in terms of those two that most of us have probably had more experience of self-indulgence than self-mortification, at least in terms of physical comfort. Does that sound true? But one of my teachers, Joseph Goldstein, has made the point that these days many of us have a tendency to psychological self-mortification, to sort of torturing or tormenting ourselves with our negative self-talk. But just in case any of you are not familiar with self-indulgence, it's the tendency to take refuge in sense pleasures. seeking out all kinds of different pleasant sense experiences and putting a lot of energy into the world out there, manipulating our external conditions to try and make ourselves happy, which, as most of us know from our own experience, is only ever partially successful, only ever temporarily successful. And the downside of that strategy is that it keeps us dependent on external conditions being a certain way in order for us to be happy. It doesn't allow us to strengthen the inner qualities that would allow us to experience some degree of ease and okayness even in the midst of life's challenges. And at times on retreat, we see this dependence on external conditions quite strongly. We don't have the same degree of ability to control our usual comforts. And so we can find ourselves fixated on the things that we do feel like we have some control over. We want our food to be like this and not like that. We want our bedrooms to be like this and not like that. We want other people to be like this and not like that. We want ourselves to be like this and not like that. And all of that preference and struggle and efforts to make things be just the way we want them to be can be extremely tiring. And when it's unsuccessful, we can find ourselves getting caught in surprisingly reactive states. Again, I'm speaking from my own experience, but I don't think that I'm alone. Anybody had that experience? Yeah. So getting caught in self-indulgence is one extreme. And as I said, the other is the self-mortification, the psychological self-torture that many of us have strong tendencies towards, unworthiness and inadequacy and even self-loathing. And consciously or unconsciously, we often bring these tendencies with us into our meditation practice. And then our whole meditation becomes yet another self-improvement project, one that's driven by self-judgment, inadequacy, anxiety, fear, and so on, different forms of the afflictive energy of aversion that we were exploring earlier. So as an antidote to that unbalanced approach to practice, I've been really appreciating framing the teachings around that metaphor that I mentioned earlier of the two wings to awakening, being wisdom and compassion. And as I said the other day, that is such a simple metaphor, but it very clearly conveys the need for balance. We need both wings to be equally well developed if we're going to fly. So just some quick working definitions about what these two wings are. Wisdom is the ability to see clearly, to develop insight. And it includes all of the mindfulness practices that we've been doing on retreat so far, bringing awareness to the breath and the body and feeling tones and so on. Compassion is the willingness to turn towards suffering, towards pain, stress, distress, and to meet it with kindness, and, where possible, to help that suffering release. And perhaps because we are in the insight tradition, the wisdom wing of the practice has tended to get a lot more emphasis, and much less attention generally has been paid to the compassion wing. So just to say that in the context of this metaphor, the compassion wing includes all skillful qualities of heart and mind. So not just compassion itself, but the other Brahmaviharas of kindness and appreciative joy, equanimity, also dana or generosity, and so on. I'll be coming back to those Brahmaviharas shortly, but for now, just to stay with the big picture, most of us tend to have a bias more towards one wing than the other. So it's worth checking from time to time in the overall development of your practice, just to get a sense of, has the wisdom wing perhaps got a little ahead of the compassion wing? Or the opposite, as the compassion wing got too far ahead of the wisdom wing. And often, because we're in the insight tradition, we put a lot more emphasis on seeing clearly. And at first, our insights might be more on a psychological level, and we start to recognize our own personal and psychological habit patterns, all the ways we get triggered into painful reactivity. And at this stage of the practice, it can feel like all of our so-called defilements are being shown to us in vivid, high definition. And it can feel very painful to suddenly start to have light shone on all of those previously dark and murky areas of our psyche. So there's that old joke that self-knowledge is not necessarily good news. And we can see and feel that at times in our practice. Excuse me. And then as it deepens, as we start to move beyond the psychological insights into some of the more universal insights, seeing clearly into the three universal characteristics of all experience, the truth that everything is impermanent, anicca, the truth that because of that impermanence, it's imperfect or unsatisfactory, dukkha, and it's impersonal, it's not fully under our control, anatta. So at first, this experiencing the truth that everything is impermanent, imperfect, and impersonal can be unsettling, even painful, because it challenges us to let go of some of our very deeply held beliefs about who we are and how the world is. So at these times, when we find ourselves perhaps in phases of groundlessness or resistance, we might need to change to the other wing and to strengthen the compassion wing for a while so that we can develop that resilience of heart and mind that allows us to navigate these challenges with some degree of balance. So that's just some of the ways that wisdom can get ahead of compassion. On the other hand, sometimes compassion can get ahead of wisdom. So as we start to move into the cultivation of compassion, sometimes we can start to connect with our own and others' pain so intensely that we can fall into grief and feel overwhelmed. And perhaps more than ever, and perhaps in the history of humanity, we have the misery of the world being fed into our news streams and our devices and our psyches, hour after hour, day after day, on top of our own individual dukkha and the individual and the dukkha of our families and our friends and our communities. We have global scales of misery that we're being exposed to. So it's not surprising that at times we might feel overwhelmed by all of this. And at these times we might need to consciously turn back to the wisdom wing of the practice and to strengthen, to see those two universal characteristics of impermanence and the impersonal nature of experience, to understand deeply that everything is constantly changing and that even grief and stress and unsatisfactoriness and dukkha comes and goes, and none of it is personal. So then it becomes possible to taste moments of freedom, even in the midst of difficulty. So this balancing of wisdom and compassion is one of the arts of this practice. So how do we begin to strengthen the compassion wing? Well, we're fortunate that all four of these Brahmavihara qualities, including compassion, are ones that we can train in, that we can cultivate very directly through our meditation practice. And before we go into a little bit more detail about them, I just want to say something about the term Brahmavihara itself, because it's a difficult phrase to translate into English. The word Brahma refers to a kind of god that was revered by the Brahmin tradition in India at the time of the Buddha, And we don't really have any equivalent for Brahma in our own culture. So it's sometimes translated as heavenly. And then the term vihara means dwelling place. So Brahma vihara on one level literally means the dwelling place of Brahma the god. But it's more usually translated as the divine abodes or the sublime abidings or the heavenly realms or the boundless states. And I like to highlight this aspect of the of vihara as being home. Because what these four states are really our true home when our hearts and minds are not being assailed by stress and distress and difficulty. They're where we naturally abide or dwell. And there's a sense of ease there, just as when we're in our physical homes, a place or state where we can feel relaxed and comfortable in who we truly are. So the second aspect of this term Brahmavihara that I like to highlight is the quality of boundlessness. So these qualities are sometimes referred to as the four immeasurables, with the understanding that we can cultivate them so fully, so deeply, that they become utterly unlimited, without boundaries, completely unconditional. Now, clearly that's a very high bar, so we need to keep in mind that these are practices, and we need to start where we are, and to have patience as those different qualities or flavors of love develop gradually through this process of regular training in them and cultivating them. So traditionally, this process of developing the Brahmavihara starts with the first of the four, which is metta, usually translated as loving kindness. But some or many Pali scholars and teachers these days have pointed out that loving kindness is not such a helpful translation, not so accurate. Because in English, loving kindness can sound a bit sort of wishy-washy, a little bit sentimental. And the loving part, and at least in English, can be confusing because in English the word love has such a wide range of meanings. We talk about loving ice cream, for example, and that just means we're basically greedy for it. And we have the obsession with romantic love, so the kind we hear about in popular music and in movies and read about in magazines and novels. And this kind of romantic love is very exclusive. It's reserved for only one person. It's often very emotional, unstable, and it doesn't last. So in many ways, it's the exact opposite of what we mean by the love of metta. Because metta, when it's fully developed, is completely unconditional. So instead of loving kindness, some people prefer to leave out the loving part and just translate metta as simply kindness. Kindness or friendliness, because the Pali word metta comes from the same root as the word for friendliness, which is maitri. So hopefully approaching metta as a quality of friendliness or goodwill or benevolence makes it sound a bit more accessible. And in fact, in some of the suttas, metta is simply defined as non-ill will. So hopefully that makes it sound even more accessible. It's just non-ill will. So as I've been emphasizing, we start with where we are. And in all of these trainings, we're encouraged to start with the metta, with where the metta comes most easily. And in my own practice, recently I've started tuning into the wildlife, the creatures of the different centers that I teach at around the world, as a way of connecting to a pretty simple and easy source of metta. And I offer this as a possibility because for some people, starting with non-human beings is the more accessible way in. Many of us can have fairly complicated or complex relationships with other humans. But our relationship to animals and birds and fish, sometimes even insects, is usually less complex. So it can be an easy place to start. And so today here I was thinking about, well, what kind of birds that we see around BMIMC for me evoke this quality of metta? And it was pretty easy. I instantly thought of crimson rosellas, those blue and red parrots. Because even after having lived here on and off for many years, whenever I see that flash of vivid blue and red, just for a moment there's that little spark of awe, kindness and appreciation and warmth. So I don't know if you noticed when you think of or hear that description of the parrots, whether there was any subtle response in your own beings that might be in the terrain of metta, just to tune in and see. And if not, don't worry. Maybe birds just aren't your thing. That's fine. Perhaps some other wild or domestic creature is. And over the next few days, you might want to just tune into the environment here and see if you can find some living being that helps you develop this flash of metta. So metta is the foundation quality of kindness, of goodwill, of friendliness. And when this basic goodwill turns towards what's difficult or painful or distressing, it flowers as compassion. So compassion is the willingness to turn towards pain, towards stress, towards distress, towards dukkha in all of its forms, to meet it with kindness, and wherever possible to help it to release. So because of this intention of relieving the suffering, compassion is not simply empathy. It's not just the heart that responds, that vibrates with our own and others' pain. There's also that orientation to relieving that pain wherever possible. And I'll be saying more about that in later talks on compassion. But for now, sometimes people ask, well, what's the difference between metta or kindness and compassion? So metta is a more generalized or even generic form of kindness and goodwill, whereas compassion is oriented specifically towards pain and suffering. So there is a close connection between the two, but energetically, compassion, to me at least, feels a bit different. So to get a sense of this, I'd like to use another bird image. This one is not from my own direct experience, but I think it captures this quality of compassion quite well. So a couple of years ago, a friend showed me a short clip, video clip on YouTube, and it looks like it was shot on somebody's phone just outside their window, and it's in winter, I'm guessing in the U.S., and it shows a little sparrow sitting on a metal railing. And it keeps sort of fluttering its wings as if it's going to take off, but it doesn't actually leave the pipe. And then you realize its tiny little feet are actually frozen onto the metal pipe. And just as you realize that, you see this giant pair of man's hands coming into the frame. And it takes this little bird and it cups the sparrow to stop it struggling. And then the man starts breathing on the metal around the bird's feet. And after a few seconds, the metal warms up just enough so that the bird's feet can be free. And the man says, "Here you go, little birdie. Go ahead and fly away." And the bird does. So you might notice, like even now, I mean, it's a little bit sentimental, but I still feel impacted by the vision of that frozen bird having its feet freed by this big man. So to me, that's the flicker of the kindness that orients towards pain. So maybe you noticed, did you notice in your own hearts and minds some flicker of movement that felt a little bit different than metta? Just subtly, though great. This is part of the skill, being able to tune in to the body, the heart, the mind, and recognize these different flavors. So then we come to mudita, which is sometimes translated as sympathetic joy, altruistic joy. I prefer appreciative joy, because traditionally the orientation is towards sharing in other people's happiness. So just as metta, when it turns towards pain, flowers as compassion, when that same metta or goodwill turns towards it's going well, turns towards success, it flowers as mudita. It tunes into our success and good fortune. And of these four Brahmavihara qualities, mudita seems to be the poor cousin. It gets the least exposure, the least airtime for some reason, perhaps because our dominant Western culture is so oriented to individualism and competitiveness, and the idea of feeling happy for other people's happiness is a little bit alien or foreign. So for many people, mudita is the most challenging of the four Brahmaviharas. But if we persevere, we can find that the ability to celebrate other people's happiness brings us many benefits. We start to understand that, contrary to our assumptions, excessive self-preoccupation is a recipe for unhappiness rather than happiness. And even many centuries ago, the Tibetan master Shantideva understood this when he said, "All the joy the world contains has come through wishing happiness for others. All the misery the world contains has come through wanting pleasure for oneself." So as we continue cultivating mudita, our sense of separateness and isolation and lack can start to diminish, and we feel more connected to others, kinder and more generous. We stop taking our problems quite so personally and recognize that all beings want to be happy just as we do. So we can more easily understand the truth of interconnectedness. So in this way, mudita can very directly support the development of insight. So again, continuing with the bird metaphors, I was wondering, well, what kind of bird evokes mudita? And I was fortunate to be on one of my usual walks up and down the lane outside BMIMC here. And I revisited the nest of a bowerbird that a neighbor showed me for the first time a couple of years ago. And I was happy to see that although the construction of the bower wasn't there anymore, there was still this incredible collection of blue things all around it. And I saw the male bowerbird dart into the bushes and keep its beady eye on me in case I was going to steal one of those precious treasures. So there's this almost like a mandala of blue milk bottle tops and blue straws and blue rosella feathers and blue clothes pegs all arranged in this loose kind of circle. And just seeing all those blue things, again, it created this flicker of delight, feeling for the... This may be anthropomorphizing a bit too much, but just feeling that sense of delight that the bowerbird had in creating something beautiful to attract a mate. So again, you might notice as you hear that description, what's the response in the heart? Is there a flicker of something that's subtly different from the compassion or the metta? So now we come to the fourth and the last of these four Brahmaviharas, which is upekkha, usually translated as equanimity. And it's not a particularly common word in English anymore. In fact, I don't think I'd even heard the word until I started exploring the Buddha's teachings. And it basically means balance of mind, evenness, stability, non-reactivity. It's the capacity to meet whatever our experience is with some degree of balance and acceptance. This non-reactivity is not non-responsive, though, as sometimes people misunderstand. If it's true equanimity, it has a very subtle and refined energetic quality to it. It's the capacity to stay present with whatever presents itself without moving into wanting or not wanting. So in its highest development, it's a quality of deep acceptance and peace. And the Pali word upekkha has a lot to do with seeing, with vision. So upekkha literally means to look over, which suggests being in the position to see the bigger picture. So in that sense, it links directly to the clear seeing of insight or vipassana. And I think of it sometimes as that experience of climbing up a hillside and getting above the tree line and suddenly having that expansive vista and being able to see the bigger picture and see where we came from. And in that moment of coming out into the openness and the spaciousness and the expansiveness, there's a sense of being released from my small, narrow viewpoint and feeling a sense of freedom and connection. So perhaps you might be wondering, well, what kind of bird is going to represent upekkha? And I had the same thought just a few minutes before this talk started. So I asked the staff and volunteers for any perspectives they'd like to share. And Rebecca here suggested owls. And I did remember powerful owls. I've had an image of a powerful owl on my screensaver on my computer for a long time now. And one of the things that attracts me to powerful owls is their capacity to just sit incredibly still, unmoving, unwavering, and they have those giant, intense eyes. So again, this clear seeing. I understand they have incredible night vision, so they have the clear seeing of equanimity. And they seem to me that they don't It seems to me that they don't move unless they absolutely need to. But when they do move, it's incredibly effective. They're very powerful predators. So when I was looking at images of these owls earlier, I found one and the caption said, "Powerful owl holding the back half of a common ringtail possum." And so of course, you don't really want to know what happened to the front half of the common ringtail possum, but right there is the opportunity to practice equanimity. Because much as we might appreciate the power of the powerful owl, it acts in accordance with its nature as a predator, and we might not find that aspect of it quite so appealing. But this owl is acting in accordance with its nature, not how we might wish it to act. So can we respect its nature as a predator and also see its bigger place in the natural environment without imposing our human-centric values on it? So that's a very brief intro to what these four Brahmavihara qualities are. And we'll be doing some more guided meditations and talks about them over the next few days. So for now, I wanted to take just a little bit more time to talk about how all four of these qualities are interrelated. And that we really want to practice with all four of them together if we're going to receive the full benefits of what they offer. Because if you think just like a four-ply piece of rope, a rope that's woven from four separate strands, that has a lot more strength than a single-strand rope. Likewise, the four Brahmaviharas, when we bring them all together and cultivate them equally, they provide a very powerful protection against all of the hindrances and the different types of afflictive mind states. So I've shared with some of you before my interest in how the relationship of these four Brahmaviharas started a few years ago now when I was on retreat in the Forest Refuge in Massachusetts. And at that time, one of the teachers was talking about the nature of mind. And he quoted the 19th century Tibetan meditation master Shabkar, well-known quote, "The mind nature is vivid. Is a flawless piece of crystal, intrinsically empty, naturally radiant, ceaselessly responsive." And at the time that quote really struck me. The mind nature is vivid as a flawless piece of crystal, intrinsically empty, naturally radiant, ceaselessly responsive. And I've been practicing with the four Brahma Viharas on this retreat. And so when I heard this piece about the mind being like a flawless piece of crystal, that quality of transparency made sense to me. Because when the heart mind is perfectly clear, it automatically responds in the appropriate way, with kindness or compassion or joy or equanimity, just as a diamond naturally responds to light. So sometimes the diamond flashes blue or red or yellow, depending on the light and the refraction. And all of those different colors are possible because of the diamond's innate purity. So as I was exploring this image of the diamond, I started to think about the diamond as a diagram, that sort of four-pointed shape. And I thought, metta is at the bottom as the foundation for these. And as I was saying earlier, when metta turns towards pain, it flowers as compassion. So I located compassion on one of the side points of the diamond. And then on the other side of the diamond, when metta turns towards what's going well, it flowers as mudita, or appreciative joy. So we have compassion and appreciative joy on the two side points of the diamond. And then when our capacity to open to, as they say in the Taoist tradition, the 10,000 joys and the 10,000 sorrows, when we can open to both of them equally, we bring them together and we have equanimity or upekkha at the top point of the diamond. So understanding these four in that arrangement can help us balance out the different practices at those times when perhaps we are getting pulled into some kind of imbalance. So, for example, if the metta is starting to feel perhaps a little bit dry or superficial or disconnected, we might consciously turn towards compassion to give it some juice, to connect it with, to give it a little bit more depth. On the other hand, if we find ourselves sliding into grief as we're getting too connected to compassion, we might want to consciously open to what else is going on right now. Can I also find some good news or some silver lining in the cloud? So we orient to mudita to help us come back into balance. And equanimity is almost always useful. In fact, in the Tibetan tradition, I think they put equanimity at the bottom as the foundation because it's equanimity that helps stabilize all of these qualities and not have them come out of balance. Because early on in the teachings, it was recognized that it's very easy for these qualities, at least in the beginning, to tip over into what are traditionally known as their near and far enemies. So each quality has a way that is the opposite that we can fall into, and also an aspect that looks like it's in the right terrain, but is subtly not quite there in some way. So, for example, the far enemy of metta or goodwill is ill will, pretty obvious. But the near enemy is, I'll come back to the near enemies in a moment. The far enemy of compassion is cruelty, again, the exact opposite. The far enemy of appreciative joy is envy or resentment. And for upekkha or equanimity, the far enemy is reactivity of any kind. So those are fairly easy to see because they're a long way from the target state. But the near enemies are a little harder to catch sometimes because they might seem like they're in the terrain. But if we pay closer attention, we can recognize that they're gone astray in some way. So, for example, metta or goodwill, the near enemy is dependent attachment or sentimentality or kindness with an agenda of some kind, a more transactional kind of kindness. I'll be kind and good to you if you reciprocate. For karuna or compassion, the near enemy is pity, a kind of distant sort of looking down on, oh, you poor thing over there. Glad it's not me. Poor thing. Stay over there. A little bit of a distancing. For mudita or appreciative joy, the near enemy is exuberance or giddiness or ungrounded effusiveness. And for upekkha, equanimity, the near enemy is indifference or detachment. So again, I'll be talking more about these over the next few days, but I wanted to share a passage by Caroline Jones and Paul Burroughs, two English Dharma teachers, who they've just put together this very succinct description of the Brahmaviharas as different flavors of love that really highlights the relationship between each of them. So this is how they describe the connections between them. Metta, or kindness, is the love that connects. It's an antidote to all forms of aversion. It is not attachment. If it slides into sentimentality, karuna, or compassion, brings the heart back into balance. Karuna, the love that responds, is an antidote to cruelty. It is not pity. If it slides into sorrow, mudita, or appreciative joy, brings the heart back into balance. Mudita, the love that celebrates, is an antidote to envy. It is not competitive. If it slides into agitated excitement, upekkha, equanimity, brings the heart back into balance. Upekkha, the love that allows, is an antidote to partiality. It is not indifference. If it slides into disconnection, metta brings the heart back into balance. So in that description, you might have noticed how all of these qualities circle around each other and how we come full circle at the end to metta. So if upekkha slides into disconnection, we come back to metta to bring the heart back into balance. So in this way, all of these qualities circle around and reinforce and support each other. And I think of them as creating a kind of a force field, a spiraling journey around and through all these different flavors of love that creates a beautiful force field of unconditional love. And if the concept of unconditional love sounds a bit daunting, just to remember again that these are practices, these are qualities that we can train in. So one aspect of the Buddha's teachings that I'm extremely grateful for is that he didn't just say, be kind, and then leave it at that. He gave us actual meditation practices that can help us to develop these qualities. And so, as an act of kindness, I'm going to finish this talk now. But to close, I'd like you to just take a few moments to reflect over this day of practice, to get a sense of perhaps some of the difficulties, the challenges, the struggles, and see if you can get a sense of which of these four Brahmavihara practices might be an antidote, whether that's developing more kindness or compassion, self-compassion, joy or equanimity. So to just tune in and see if one of these particular qualities feels relevant, might be useful as an antidote to the afflictive states and as a tool to help strengthen and support the skillful states. And if it just happens that today was a day when you didn't happen to contact any afflictive states, well then you can simply abide in equanimity. So thank you for your attention. Let's just take another moment or two of silence to let the words dissolve.